Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Thank you so much for tuning in. It's great to have you here, Henrik with Red Ice TV. And today we're talking with Kevin MacDonald, Professor Kevin MacDonald. We have him back on the show. He's, of course, been featured many times on Red Ice. But I'm initiating or starting a new series to kind of try to reintroduce some bigger names in the, well, countering the anti-white movement, people that are pro-European, people are speaking up against the globalization process and kind of the more pro-nationalist voices. There's a lot of different labels, of course, you can put on people in the kind of field, really, of interest that we cover here. But so, you know, we're going to do a series where we kind of go through some of the, you know, early work, really, of some of the more important voices in this field. And so, again, for those who don't know, there's a lot of new people coming aboard all the time. So Kevin MacDonald is a professor emeritus of psychology at California State University, Long Beach. After receiving his master's degree in evolutionary biology, he received a PhD in behavioral science, both at the University of Connecticut. Since assuming his position at California State University, Long Beach, his research has focused on developing evolutionary perspectives on culture, developmental psychology, and personality theory. And this includes also the origins and maintenance of monogamous marriage in Western Europe, and ethnic relations or group evolutionary strategy. Now, he's the author of more than 100 scholarly papers and reviews and several books. The most recent book is Individualism and Western Liberal Tradition, Evolutionary Origins, History, and Prospects for the Future, released in 2019. We had Kevin with us a little bit while ago speaking about this book. Of course, there's some other books too, some of maybe more famous, if you will, that's been out for a while, like The Culture of Critique, An Evolutionary Analysis of Jewish Involvement in 20th Century Intellectual and Political Movements. This was released in 1998. And then you have Separation and Its Discontents Towards an Evolutionary Theory of Anti-Semitism, also from 1998, and A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy, released in 1994. So, Kevin, it's great to have you back again, and thank you so much for coming on.
It's great to be here, Henry. You know, I notice your office is much neater than mine.
It's just a big set, you know. No, they're actually real, you know. It's actually real stuff, including the bookshelf, with, of course, some of your books in there, too, and some of the Occidental Quarterlies back in there, too. So some great stuff. Now, Kevin, again, so the goal of this a little bit is to kind of reintroduce some people and their work to, you know, to our audience, and there's a lot of new people coming aboard all the time. And why don't you just tell us a little bit about, I mean, as I read, you're a professor of psychology, you were working in the early days. Now, I want to get into this idea of how you ended up writing and talking about the things that you write and talk about today. What happened at university?
Well, I mean, I had a sort of normal career for a long time. I mean, my education was evolutionary psychology, sort of. But I was also a developmental psychologist. I taught developmental psychology and personality psychology and did research in those areas. And one aspect of developmental psychology was the history of child development, because children don't develop the same in all historical eras. And so I started reading about the history, and I wrote a book in 1998 on social and personality development. And one section of that book had to do with socializing children in ancient Sparta. And it really got me the idea of a group evolutionary strategy. I mean, this was clearly a very thought out, conscious strategy, where they decided how to organize their society in every possible way, including socializing the children. They were socialized to be soldiers, and the military. And there was no other real avenue in their society for anything. And that kind of research, I got into monogamy in Europe, because monogamy is a big problem in evolutionary thinking, because, you know, theoretically, rich and powerful males should have quite a few women. They should dominate the women. They should, like, harems, you know, as you see in ancient China and Muslim countries and Africa and all that. But you don't see them in Western culture. And so what's going on there? So that was a very formative period in the 1980s. But this and really led into the most recent book on individualism that you mentioned, because all that research began in the 1980s. The family research, the research on monogamy, I started to really get into European history. And I published a number of things in the late 80s and actually beginning of the early 80s into the 1990s. And then I got interested in Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy, and just as a sort of intellectual exercise. But it was a follow-up, really, of the stuff on Sparta that I'd already done. But I thought that, you know, that if I discussed Jews, it'd be much more interesting. It would relate to the current world as opposed to ancient Sparta, which is ancient history.
So there was just kind of one topic in a string of many that you started looking at, in other words.
It was, but they all sort of came together. In the end, because my most recent book does all of the above, you know, it does talk about the family stuff, it talks about monogamy, it talks about Jewish issues. So it really, sort of compendium everything I've ever done, including personality psychology. I have a chapter on, psychology, including personality psychology, social psychology, and so on. So, it's really, my scholarly career is right in there in that book.
Right.
It's kind of a theme, I have to admit. It's not for everyone. It's like 500 and some pages, and it's like, you know. But and that's where I have been, actually, for my last 4 years.
So tell us about that in terms of what you found in terms of Judaism and how you... Because obviously this being the prominent topic, of course, of your more recent years here for a long time now, just studying Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy and stuff like that. As you said, you had a background in psychology and stuff. But what expanded that subject or what made you continue looking at it?
Yeah, it turned into three books. I had no idea I would do that. I started out, it really was, as I say, a follow-up to the trail on Sparta. And it really was, but you know, it was the thing about Judaism is that you're talking about long stretches of historical time, and you're talking about an area that has huge amount of writing on it. You know, there's always been Jewish and some non-Jewish scholars who've been over this, you know, for like hundreds of years, really. And so it would provide a much more detailed, in-depth kind of perspective on a group strategy. So I thought it was intellectually viable, but I did the same kinds of things. I talked about socializing children. It started with the Old Testament and how it was their abhorrence of intermarriage, you know, again, just like in Sparta, there was a very clear evolutionary strategy there. In this case, it was Moses. You know, he set down the law. He set down how we're going to behave. And, they had these different tribes, like 13 tribes, I guess. And the whole tribal thing was, you know, led to some conflict within the society. But then after the Babylonian captivity, they really became consciously a diaspora people. They understood that what we were going to do in the future would be to sort of live in other communities, like in the Roman Empire. In Egypt, as a community, a closed off community, we're going to be by ourselves. We're not going to allow any mating, you know, to come in. No miscegenation. And we're going to also raise our children to be scholars. There's going to be a lot of emphasis on literacy, a lot of emphasis on business, a lot of emphasis on creating monopolies within the group. And, really treating out groups horribly. I mean, and as, you know, we see that today with Orthodox Jews and actually, there's a big problem in, New York now.
Yeah.
With the Orthodox, Jews, they tend to go in certain areas, but they don't treat the people around them nicely. And you know, all the landlords and so on in Brooklyn, they are very, very tough.
But you're saying you found this like as a conscious written out that then I would assume strategy of the group.
Right. It's the same way with Sparta. It was written out. This is how we're going to behave. And this is, you know, we're not going to allow anyone else in. It's also the case with Sparta. They didn't allow other people in. They had a way of socializing children. They had a way of, they ignored the arts. They ignored literature. Everything like that is all military. Yeah, you're going to be trained to be a soldier. And they dominated these other people. They made them into slaves. So they could then pursue this military life. And they were incredibly good soldiers for a small society, really. They dominated Greece for a long time. They had a huge war with Athens, very debilitating war on both sides, really. Incredible people. You know, they were the ones that stood up to the Persians and really defeated the Persians in the Battle of Thermopylae, I believe. And that really saved the West. I mean, imagine if the Persians had won that. Who knows? It would have been different. You know, they were not a Western culture.
Yeah.
It was sort of Indo-European, but they had miscegenated so much over there. It's a slave society, despotic and everything else. Very different from the West.
Yeah. So you're talking about like things that you've, I guess, in your these are journals and academic stuff that you're coming across that is suggesting that this is a conscious strategy, obviously for survival reasons, I would assume, because of they were captured, enslaved in so many different empires, starting from, well, we don't really know where they show up from. It's kind of a mystery in itself, really. You can go back to the Bronze Age and see invasions of different groups and, of course, the collapse of a lot of the ancient empires and stuff like that. But yeah. Moving forward, then they of course come to be very proficient in certain fields as well. How do we explain that? Do you think
it's just like with the Spartans? I mean, from early childhood they were trained to be soldiers, so they got to be very good at it. I mean, they were training all the time. The same way with Jews, they had very consciously decided during the Roman Empire. To adopt this educational strategy. And there was a time there where they got rid of all the ones who weren't very scholarly, that really couldn't hack it. It really was, a process of weeding out the not so intelligent and creating a group with a higher intelligence.
So eugenics.
It was eugenics. There's no question about it. If you were a poor Jew and you were not very smart and all that, well, they sort of, encouraged you to leave, They did not want you around. And I think they also self-consciously thought that they had to do this to compete in the ancient world with the Greeks. The Greeks were very intelligent people. They were dominating the commercial business kind of things and intellectually and everything else. Of course, the Romans came in and conquered it all, but even then, the Greeks were really much more intellectual than the Romans. And I do think that they felt they had to, up their game, you might say, and self-consciously made this decision. So young Jewish children started going to school at a very early age, and they became literate. Very few people, if you look at other the surrounding society, they were much higher level of literacy than, say, the Romans did in general. Instead of this upper crust, very few people who were literate, you had education beginning, in childhood, early childhood, and emphasizing Torah, and everything else was subsidiary. They didn't care about military things. They didn't care about science or anything like that. There were no Jewish scientists or mathematicians or anything else in the ancient world. It was all based on this religious study, and which we still see now in Orthodox Jewish communities. That's what they teach. Just the other day, I saw this thing that the state of New York is coming down on these Orthodox communities because they're not teaching secular studies, and some of them can hardly speak English. They're much more oriented towards Hebrew. They're isolated and they focus totally on Jewish studies.
So do you think, obviously then, the Orthodox is more similar to how they were back then, as opposed to obviously Reformed Judaism and the modern Jewish liberal element, I guess, right?
The Orthodox Jews, they retain really what traditional Judaism always was. They dress differently, they had their own schools, they completely shut themselves off. If someone intermarries, they are going to be expelled from the community. If someone is a heretic, they and their whole family will suffer for that. I mean, there are these stories of Jews, Orthodox Jews, who decide that they don't want to do that anymore, and it's heart wrenching for them. I mean, they just have a hard time letting go, and then they are vilified within the community, and the whole family suffers for it. It's just like in the old days, if you did any of that stuff, or you got married to a non-Jew, well, you would be ostracized in the community, and your whole family would have a black mark on it. No one would want to marry into your family. So it was a very, you can imagine the huge social obligation you would feel to stay on the straight and narrow and keep obeying the law.
Interesting. I want to return to that, see if we can talk about that later, because regarding, you know, intermarriage and stuff, the way that the Jewish community have kind of ascended, if you will, within Western societies and higher up the ranks and becoming aristocratic families such as the Rothschilds, and there's many others, which of course have become a very powerful component today. Their influence is massive. Their wealth is massive. Their influence is just, you know, in relation to how few they are, is just, you know, completely out of balance, so to speak. But tell us again, if you can, try to get closer to what was it that took you kind of from, I guess, finding some of those things, and then what led you up to both a People That Shall Dwell Alone, but also Culture of Critique, of obviously seeing and recognizing the patterns that this is also now something that is detrimental to Europeans or Western Europeans in particular. What happened there?
Well, that's exactly it. The first book on the People That Shall Dwell Alone was well received, and academically, it was, you know, it was just about how they got along in traditional societies and what it was about and how they were structured. But as I went along, and I, you know, you have to be, I read more and more. I read a lot about anti-Semitism, and got a theory of, you know, I really tried to place that within an evolutionary perspective and a psychological perspective. And, you know, modern treatments of anti-Semitism are just by these Jewish scholars are just apologetic. I mean, they don't seriously try to see things from the other person's point of view. Yeah, so I wrote Separations, Discontents, and that one was much less well received because I took a sort of hard-edged view that Jews had certain behavioral tendencies that were angering other peoples, you know, exploitation, economic exploitation for one. You know, that's so common, like in Europe in the Middle Ages, you know, lending money, collecting taxes. I mean, this is one of the most outrageous things. Can you imagine a society where the king delegates tax collecting to these Jews who then pay the king a certain amount up front to do this, and then just go in there and get whatever they can from the people?
Is that what happened?
It's an outrageous system. Yeah,
that's what happened.
Areas in Spain and other places in Europe, and it was just.
And somehow the king allowed that, or like they.
I mean, the kings were not on the side of the people. Quite
See, that's what's so bizarre about this, you know.
And so, what the Jews would do is make alliances with the king and the other aristocrats against the people. And they self-consciously did that. They knew damn well that they were allied with the elites, and they would often try to marry their daughters into the elites.
Right.
They would exploit the rest of the people without any conscience. And that's the thing, that, you know, if you look at how Jews conceptualize ethics, they can say completely within group. You know, so you can do whatever you want to people who are not Jewish. But with other Jews, there's a huge ethical code. You can't, you know, steal a monopoly from another Jew or compete with them economically. You have to, you know, respect their monopoly or whatever. And there are all these rules about how you interact with other Jews. With non-Jews, you can do everything from slavery to, you know, horrendous interest rates to outrageous confiscatory taxes, whatever. And so it doesn't matter. And so that came through pretty clear in the historical record. And of course, is never mentioned by these Jewish apologists. And so that is really an eye opener for me. I said, I mean, these are not really nice people.
But that's interesting. That means that is like available in the academic works, but no one has kind of, I guess, applied in the same way that you had at that time, at least, applied that, okay, I can see a pattern in behavior here, and obviously this would have negative consequences among the societies that they lived, right?
That's going to anger people. And so repeatedly there would be hostility. And oftentimes you'd have the king siding with the Jews against the rest of the people, you know, quelling pogroms and riots and other things, really trying to keep order. The scholar who's really taken this up is Andrew Joyce, and he's done some really great material on historical anti-Semitism. I recommended his writings on anti-Semitism very highly. If you look at it, you know, there's so many Jewish apologists now. They just want to blame, and it's just part of the whole anti-Western zeitgeist of the academic world now, where everything about the past is pathological on the part of Westerners. There was this primitive hatred of Jews because of the idea that they killed Christ. That's sort of the end of it. And so that produced all the tensions in subsequent history. It's a joke. I mean, they can't stand the most cursory examination, but that's the way it is. And these are powerful people because, you know, so many Jews are academics, and they will rewrite history. They will write it from their own perspective. They will never ever blame Jews for anything. So I realized I was up against a sort of consensus, but then I really realized these people are not really on our side. And when I started reading on culture critique, that became even more obvious. You know, reading about psychoanalysis and sort of undermining, subverting the Western sexual culture and marriage culture and that sort of thing. And
so the picture that you were painting was something that developed slowly. It wasn't the one thing that all of a sudden clicked and you're like, oh my God, this is detrimental to us, right? Go ahead.
The culture critique material came in my mindset, where I really started seeing these people as hating us and doing their best to undermine us and really replace us now.
Yeah.
That took a long time, but certainly the book on anti-Semitism started that. But then reading culture critique, you see Jews involved in communism. And then you realize, 20 million people were murdered in the Soviet Union at a time when Jews were the elite. Especially when I got to the material on immigration.
I want to work myself up there to that point a little bit, and I want to talk about the anti-Semitism. I even have a clip here. I saw it a while back, and I was just shocked at the attitude. I think you'll have some interesting comments on that, too. It's a lady called Bari Weiss. She writes for the New York Times opinion section, among others, regarding anti-Semitism. But before you get into that and just talk about that and how that shaped, one thing and I don't know if you've studied that or if you even know have any answers to that, but one thing that's very strange to me is this idea that Jews were always outsiders. They saw themselves as outsiders. In many cases, they literally like walked into a new kingdom, a new country, a new area. They established themselves there, sometimes successfully, sometimes, I guess, not, depending on what they did or whatever. But how do you think that they, I mean, because like with Germany, right? I mean, they slowly kind of walked up to Europe and more into Western Europe and stuff like that. How do you think they were able to put themselves in a position where they became so snug with the not only the elites, but even the kings and queens in some ways? Was it money? Did they have wealth? How did they get there, do you think?
They had wealth, and they were outsiders, and the kings understood that. And again, these kings were not on the side of the people. I mean, the Magna Carta has clauses about Jewish money lending. You know, because the king wanted to take his cut of the money lending. But then you had all these barons who were going bankrupt, and the king was agreeing with all that. And so they forced the king to sign this, and it was an important document in the history of England. And but that's the thing. They've always had. They tend to have quite a bit of money. I mean, at least at the top of the Jewish group, and they would be able to come into a society and make deals with the king. I mean, but they did it in Muslim societies as well. Especially if the ruler was not of the same ethnic group as the people. You know, when you had a hostile alien elite, then it was easy. But they, in Western Europe, you know, there was a shift. And so like King Louis the Ninth, expelled the Jews. They expelled the Jews in England in the early 13th century. And other areas. And so they were gradually pushed out of Western Europe. And of course that is now seen as a horrible, horrible thing that, shows the pathology of Western society. But, you know, from my point of view, this was a very rational thing, and King Louis was very much on the side of the people. He was not one of these rulers who sided with these alien elites, this alien group who wanted to exploit his people. And he offered them the ability to, you know, it was one of these Jewish myths that the kings only allowed them to lend money. Well, that's not even true.
Yeah, it's exactly. I've heard so much about that, and it's even strange that they managed to walk into a new territory and set up a bank or something like this. They were so suppressed and so discriminated against that the only thing we could do was to take control of the financial system by setting up a bank. That doesn't make sense to me.
And they would do things like they funded William the Conqueror, you know, when he came into conquered England in 1066.
Yeah. William of Orange, right?
But yeah, in return, you know, they got to lend money and other things with when they got there,
mm-hmm.
and so that set off because they had, I guess they hadn't been there before in numbers anyway.
Here's a map of the expulsions, by the way, from. I guess 1100 to 1800, which of course some people say it's 192 or something like that, but there's, I mean, it's impossible to know all the places, to be honest, you know.
Yeah. And then, you know, just common sense living. You see this on Twitter and everything. Yeah. You know, what's the common sense of that? If you've been expelled that many times, hundreds of times really, from all these different places, times and over centuries, is that about you or about the people that are expelling you? I mean,
right.
There's something about you that is doing this, but of course that never registers with them. I mean,
yeah, isn't it about that there's zero self-reflection? And you know, in many cases, we are asked to self-reflect. Was it something that I did, or you know, what's my guilt? In this situation, when things go bad, what did I do that was wrong? How could I change? But that doesn't seem to come into this equation when it comes to European history, anti-Semitism, and who's to blame, right?
Right. It's our proneness to guilt, and you know, we are easily triggered for guilt, and I think Jewish intellectuals understood that, and that's why we have so much propaganda that is guilt-inducing. The Holocaust and all of European history is presented in a way to induce guilt. And then, of course, we have other things like the slave trade and all that. But that's, we are much more prone, I think, to self-reflection about these things. Come to think of it, I've never tried to analyze this in terms of individualism, but it may well be a trait of individual, because we are, and this has been documented by anthropologists, and, that the West is a guilt-prone society compared to others. Others are shame-prone, where they are worried about what other people will think or something, but mm-hmm. guilt is internal. You feel bad yourself for having participated in something.
Are you saying that that's consciously being exploited?
Yes, I think it is. I do think. And I think that institutional intellectuals understood individualists, that a big part of that, my last book, is about moral communities, that Westerners want to feel that they are good people. And because your reputation is the coin of the realm, not your kinship relations. So what's important is, are you a good person? Can I trust you? That is what we value in the West. And Jewish intellectual movement, they understood that. So all the propaganda is now directed at, if you don't believe it and everything that Elizabeth Warren does, you are a bad person. You are not just wrong, you're evil. And we don't want to really talk to you. And we're seeing that more and more. I mean, my own case, I got family members who won't talk to me.
Right.
It's very sad to see this because they don't think you are honest. They don't think you are trying your best to figure these things out. They think you're an evil person. You're like somebody who, a pedophile or a murderer or bank robber or something. You are an evil person. And that's a very, and we are prone to that. I mean, and it was very hard for me, and I'm sure you or everybody, when you first start this, you do feel, socially that you have to, justify yourself and you feel guilty. I did put up a lot of hostility where I taught. Cal State Long Beach, and it was, especially at first, it really was mortifying. You would feel guilty. But then I'm saying, for what? I'm just trying to figure this out.
What made you persevere that and take that choice instead of, let's say, just closing up that chapter, like, all right, I'm out of here, kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, that would be the thing to do, and I think some people don't want to go there. I mean, I think there are a lot of self-censorship in our world now. And in the academic world, that's certainly the case. We watch what we say, and we know that if we say certain things, that we will at least be ostracized and be vilified, and we may lose our jobs if we're not secure in some way.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, it's good that you persevered, because so very few people talk about this, and of course now this has become a dominant part, not the only part, but a big component in what it is that's happening in Europe, in the West, in countries that's been founded by people of European descent. We're seeing mass migrations, open borders. There's a combination, of course, of guilt being used against us, our history, and all these pieces play a part that you said, including things like the Holocaust, anti-Semitism, the slave trade. These kinds of things. It's all painting a picture of why we are, where we are today. And of course, as you have studied, Jewish influence is it's a major component to why we are where we are today, right? So this is an interesting question to raise. Now, why don't we do this, is to glide into the topic of anti-Semitism. There's a couple of things we could play, but let's begin with this one. It's Barry Weiss, who's talking with Bill Mayer, and I kind of want to get your take on this a little bit as well. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but let's take a look at it. It's a longer clip, so we could either we pause in the middle or we'll just play portions of it. But check this out here.
Staff editor and writer for the New York Times op-ed section and author of the new book, How to Fight Anti-Semitism, Barry Weiss is back with us. Barry Weiss. Hello. How are you? It's great to see you.
Me too.
Oh, you got your cards. You're all ready to go.
Get nervous, Bill.
I know. Well, let's talk about your book. You must know your book
Light
pretty
topic.
Well. You just wrote it.
Yeah.
Well, I thought, yeah, of course it is very serious, but I thought the interesting, many interesting parts of it, but something I would like to hear you talk about is the fact that anti-Semitism, it's more than just about the Jews. It's about the health of a society that for pretty much all through human history, as certainly as long as the Jews have been around, whenever a society becomes anti-Semitic, it's an indication about something wrong in their body politic. That's interesting to me.
That's exactly right. I wrote this book because my synagogue in Pittsburgh.
That's the pinnacle of it, right? But this is how it's framed now. This is,
this is how it's framed, yeah. But it's amazing. Think about it. You've got this Barry Weiss. She's an ethnic activist, and clearly an ethnic activist. Jewish activist on the op-ed pages of the New York Times, lead media, and then she's interviewed. Rice book. Yeah, it's amazing.
It is. Let me play some more here.
One that was shot up in October 27, 2018. But because the more I researched this topic and looked at Jewish history, and really all of history, I found that societies where anti-Semitism thrives are societies that are dead or dying. Why is that? It's because anti-Semitism is the ultimate conspiracy. And when anti-Semitism thrives, it's a sign that that society has replaced truth with lies. And so anti-Semitism is a kind of, the one way to think about it is that it's a thought virus that's carried forward in civilization. And just like any of us have lots of viruses in our body at a given time, right. As long as we're healthy, they don't show themselves. When a society begins to become unhealthy and tearing itself apart, as we see here and throughout Europe, anti-Semitism begins to show its face.
But why the...
What's your reply to that, Kevin? That it's a mental disease in the mind of Europeans, essentially, a thought virus.
Well, it's typical, I think, of Jewish apologists that they don't want to look at what was really going on. They don't want to look at Jewish behavior at all. If there is, are there anti-Jewish feelings? It is because there's something wrong with the people around them. And that's inevitable. And that's just that's their standard line every time now.
Is there anything comparable? Like, white people all of us say, well, the reason why, let's say, blacks kill more white people is because they have a disease in their mind or something, or that they, why they rob people, or why there's a discrepancy between, like, let's say, rape statistics between, like, say, non-whites and whites or something like that.
Exactly. And there are cases, clear cases of societies that have done very well after the Jews were expelled or they became conscious of Jews. For example, 15th century Spain, you had the Inquisition. It was all about the Jews. And they left, they were expelled. And then you had the conversos who were, you know, pretending to be Christian, but they weren't really. And they were still there. But the Inquisition was all about rooting them out and ending their power because they become very powerful. They were in with the king and the whole thing. But then after that happened, you had the flowering of Spain. I mean, they had just gotten rid of the Moors. They discovered America, and then there was all this gold. They became a dominant military power in Europe for a long time after that. Then you have England. They expelled the Jews in the 13th century. Did England go to hell after that? No, it was a sign of health that they did that. And then you had this incredible development that happened after that with no Jews in England at all until Cromwell invited them back in 1660 or so, 1650s. And they by that time had gone through the Queen Elizabeth era where they defeated Spain. They had colonies in North America. I mean, there were all kinds of great things happening for the English. They were the most advanced society in Europe at that time. No question about it. And it wasn't because of the Jews, hello.
So you're saying in terms of the historical aspect of that, that's just wrong, that sure, there might have been... It's interesting, though, because in one end, isn't it an admission? Because she's saying as Jews are there and as they're... She's not saying as the Jews dominated a society, but as they are there, things are beginning to decline, and it's dying, the society. And so the question is, why is that? But then your counterattack to that is essentially, well, look what happened after they actually do the expulsions. In many cases, they end up thriving.
Yeah, and just think what would have happened had Jews stayed there. If the similar kinds of things would have happened, where there was a rising middle class, the end of serfdom, and all those things that created the modern world in England, and the modern world really was created in England, that it would have been a Jewish middle class. It wouldn't have been a native middle class. They would have dominated just like they did in Eastern Europe, and they were dominating in Germany. And the other example is after National Socialism triumph in 1933, you had a flowering, really, of German culture. In many ways, they were very, very productive, the arts and everything. What their complaints about Weimar certainly had to do with you know, the sexual corruption, and then they could see communism going on in the USSR and how horrible it was, how murderous it was. And everybody in Europe knew that Jews had a huge role in the Bolshevik Revolution and what happened after that.
Now, a lot of that has been covered up, hasn't it, Kevin? That even if you go back to like, I think it was 1850, I think it's like essentially the peak of like people discussing Jews and Judaism as one of the most prominent issues in Europe at that time. Like, what do we do? Like, how do we solve this issue, right? But that's been covered up, consequently.
It's been covered up, the whole thing. And Jews were welcomed into European society, but the idea always was, from the standpoint of Europeans, they assumed that Jews would become just like them. And that's a common fault of ours, I think, that we do assume that, and we assume they'll become just like us. Well, they never did. They retained their group ties. They retained their sense of being apart from Europe. And so when these intellectuals became prominent, they were critics of Europe. Their image of European history is just like Barry Weiss's. Barry Weiss views European history as one long veil of tears for Jews. And it's because European society is fundamentally pathological. That's how they see it.
There's a map of Europe's synagogues, which, of course, as you say, I mean, sure, as a technicality, I sure you can have a different religion, but of course, this is a separate issue as well, because there's an ethnic component. So it's not just that they have a different religion; they see themselves as a distinct, separate, different people. Obviously, which they are genetically. You can find these. If you take a DNA test, you can see if you have percentage of Jewish, DNA in you or not. But let's return. I just want to show that quickly to show that. You know, it's not that these people have integrated into European society and start going to churches as opposed to synagogues. They have very distinct areas which are theirs. They have, you know, a distinct, there's small colonies essentially, in Europe and other parts as well. Let's go back to that clip and continue watching it. See how Bill Maher, what he hits back with here.
Why the Jews? Why do they have the kick me sign on their back?
Well, I'll have to go back to the book of Matthew, and even before that to Egypt in 300 BCE.
I mean, there's so many different peoples in the world.
Sure.
Why, a lot of them have gotten shit from a lot of people,
but it just seems
the Jews are always on the move.
Yeah, we are. We are. Okay, and I think here's one reason for it.
So,
when the Jews rejected Jesus as the Son of God.
Oh, that thing.
Okay, that thing.
That's right. I knew there was something I had forgotten at that whole
thing. That little detail.
Do you want to comment on that?
That is just absolutely, that's the thing. They'll go back to that as if that has colored all of Western history. It's ludicrous. They're much more sophisticated Jewish apologists than this woman. Believe me.
No, of course. Yeah.
This is the lowest level of Jewish apologia. This is the kindergarten version. The others will be at least a little bit more sophisticated than that. This is just ridiculous. I can't even believe.
I mean, obviously, there's an issue there, though, right? I mean, again, a question is how much weight there is to it. But this aspect that, you know, Jesus was a Jew, and he of course was, I think, primarily for the Jewish people. He was meant to be their Messiah, the person who solved these things, and he kind of called or asked for a change in the behavior, ostensibly, right? Turn the other cheek. He threw them out of the money, the temple, and all those kinds of things, right? And then majority of Jews rejected that, right? And that this is an issue that, because they essentially killed Christ, right? They handed him over to the Romans to kill him and stuff like that. That's always at the forefront in these arguments, that that's the reason why Europeans hate Jews. But you're saying it's like, that's kind of a, I'm not saying it's a non-issue, but it's like not that important, are you saying?
No, if you look at what anti-Semites have written throughout the centuries, going back to the ancient world, you know, if you look at the church fathers, they said horrible things about Jews. And it wasn't because of Jews killed Christ. It was because Jews had become economically dominant in the Roman Empire. You know, there was a time when they were not, because You know, there was the wars in 70 AD, the Roman legions went in and destroyed the temple. And then you had, the war in 135 AD, I believe. And, but after that, the Jews gradually start building up their power, economic power. And when, and in the ancient world, slavery was the norm. And so they were enslaving, non-Jews. They were the slave traders, and there was a lot of hatred. And so, I have a chapter, the third chapter, I think, yeah, the third chapter of my book, Separation of Discontents, is about this whole era. And my view is that the Catholic Church in the later Roman Empire began as an anti-Jewish movement. You look at what the Church Fathers said about Jews. They hated the Jews. And the whole point was to erect this institution that would combat the Jews. And so their ideology was Jews killed Christ. And that was, that was their theology.
Okay. Now that's very interesting. You're saying that due to the fact that Europeans were so religious at that point, that was one of the strongest arguments you could use. But because when she says it, when this woman and others says it, obviously what you're saying is it's a straw man argument, but you're saying to use today a theological excuse puts it in the realm of something being irrational, essentially, right? I mean, from the modern mind, so to speak. But as opposed to admitting that there is a financial element, or which would put it in the rational realm. So she doesn't have to admit and say, well, we were dominant in all these fields and there was abuse, or like, you know, they mistreated people and that's why they got angry. To say that would be an admission of a crime. So yeah. So they place it in a theological sense because that makes it an irrational one to them. I'm not saying if people are, you know, religious out there, but you see what I'm saying? That could be the reason, maybe?
Yeah. In this case, I think slavery was the big issue. The Jews were enslaving Christians. That there were a lot of laws in the Roman Empire directed against Jews. Jews were kicked out of the civil service, and they were prevented from owning Christian slaves. And those laws were, you know, they kept, you know, cropping up again and again, because it, you know, it probably, they probably weren't always enforced. But, there was real hatred there. It wasn't just about Jews killing Christ, but the idea of Jews killing Christ was a powerful ideology. There's no question about it.
Right.
And there were times in European history when the popes, you know, reined in Jewish power. They would, you know, make them wear insignias, signs of the Jewish star. They would prevent them from charging interest, you know, lending money, that sort of thing. I mean, it happened periodically.
Yeah.
But of course, the big trend in European history was not that. They did make these alliances, and then they were often expelled, and they produced hostility. And, you know, it's just, like I said, this is the kindergarten version of what happened.
Yeah.
This is like ludicrous. But that's what we see in the New York Times and this elite
media. Yeah, exactly. She's New York Times. This is what they're putting on TV, Bill Maher, HBO, you know.
Yeah, would the New York Times allow me to write an op-ed? No, they would not do that.
No. Mm-hmm. No competing ideologies and ideas here. Let's listen a bit more here.
Always comes back to him and his bad day.
No, but just think about it. Just think about it for one second. So if you look at the idea that the Jews get the most power, the tiny Jews get the most powerful empire in the world, the Roman Empire, to do their bidding by killing Jesus. And if you look at the anti-Semitic tropes that we see now, what is the Jew? The Jew is not, it's not like racism where the person of color is subhuman and the racist is punching down. In the anti-Semitic conspiracy theory, the Jew is the wily manipulator, the puppeteer, the person close to power that gets power to do its bidding. And in a way, it all goes back to that original conspiracy.
Well, I am no expert on Judaism, although I try never to pay retail.
Yeah.
You and me both, brother.
But
you're going to get in trouble for that. I'm excited.
Like I could give a fuck.
Like this week will be different. But you also make the point that they're kind of getting it. The Jews are from both sides. I mean, it was always the right, the fascists. They always had a thing out for the Jews. But, in the last 20, 30 years, it's also been the left. And, I mean, you talk about how being anti-Semitic now is survivable.
It
is. In American politics.
Well, it's certainly survivable in European politics. I mean, just look at the Labour Party, which is run by an anti-Semite, Jeremy Corbyn, who's transformed, one of the most important political parties in his image.
One Jew. Isn't that great? One Jew.
But look what's happening. I mean, my fear is that that sort of thing could be happening in the Democratic Party. And I see that in, the squad that you and
this
Michael were talking about before, where... Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, some members of the squad support the BDS movement against Israel, which seeks nothing less than the elimination of any Jewish state between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea.
I mean,
now, why do you think she takes it in that direction, as opposed to, let's say, how Jews are treated in America or something? It actually is centered now around Israel and the BDS movement, anti-Semitism.
I find it ludicrous. She is basically saying that people on the left don't like Jews because Jews killed Christ. I mean, it can't possibly come down to that. But it's about Israel, obviously.
Israel, yeah.
And Jeremy Corbyn, he's called an anti-Semite. Why? Because he criticizes Israel. That's basically what it is.
And that's it. I mean, he bends backward to appease and make sure he, I know I'm not an anti-Semite and all that stuff. It's just a disagreement, essentially, of how, I mean, we can't even say that Israel is an ethno-state, but it is, right? Well, we can say it, but I'm saying in mainstream circles, they hardly discuss those aspects. But they essentially don't like Israel because they see it as a right-wing fascist country, the Labour Party in Corbyn, right?
They're being honest. I mean, they have these values, and Israel is the absolute opposite of these values. I mean, they're ethnically cleansing. Their immigration policy is restricted to one group. The Orthodox rabbis will prevent marriage if you can't prove your Jewish credentials going way back. So if you go to Israel and you're not married, you're not going to be able to get married unless you can do that, because in fact Jews they go outside of Israel to get married. Because anyway, she made a ridiculous point in the discussion. She's saying that, you have this historical anti-Semitism built on Jews killing Christ. Then all of a sudden, you've got this modern theory that Jews are the puppeteers. They're the ones who pull the strings behind the scenes and all that. And that's basically the same thing. No, it's not the same thing. What people are saying on the right is Jews have huge influence, that they are a dominant elite, and that they are a dominant elite, especially in the media, in the academic world, in the political culture, and they have influence. That's why she has her job at the New York Times, which is owned by Jews. To say that this somehow is the same as killing Christ is ludicrous.
Is she alluding to, she's saying it was the Jews that wanted to kill Christ and they managed to manipulate the Romans into doing their bidding, right? That's what she's... In the same way, I guess, that, let's say, Kushner managed to get Trump to drop bombs on Iran or drone strike Soleimani or something. Do you see what I'm saying? That's what she's alluding to, I would assume.
Okay, well, that makes some sense. But again, the idea is that Jews are an elite and they do have influence. And of course, what Pontius Pilate did was basically give in to the fact that Jews at that time in Judea would be very upset if Jesus was allowed to live. I suppose there's a puppeteering aspect to that, but it's very different from historical anti-Semitism, unless you really do see historical anti-Semitism fundamentally about Jews being an exploitative elite that does not have the interests of the people at heart. And that's what's going on now. But anti-Semitism for the left is very interesting. And it's about Israel. That Israel does not measure up to these, idolization of multiculturalism. And people like Barry Weiss want to somehow square that circle and get people on the left to be gung-ho pro-Israel no matter what they do to the Palestinians. And, of course, what the organized Jewish community has done now is basically advocate censorship. In Europe, they have laws and criminal penalties in France for saying things that Jews don't like. And now you have Trump signing this executive order on BDS and the Boycott the Bestman Sanctions Movement that basically is going to outlaw that. And there have already been some cases. There were two or three things just today on MondoWise about that what's happening now is that there's this move for censorship, and now it's got the power of the federal government behind it. You realize Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the ADL, just called for Congress to enact laws against criticizing Israel.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's just an incredible thing. Because they, criticizing Israel is now equated with anti-Semitism.
I was just going to say, they've turned successfully anti-Zionism, I should say, into anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
That's what they're trying to do.
They've been conflated. And at first, the organized Jews, big time, strongly identified Jews would make this distinction. You can criticize Israel, and that's not anti-Semitism. Now they don't do that. And the reason is because they cannot justify what Israel's done. They simply can't do it. The only thing they can do is shut people up. And that's what they're trying to do. And here's another one. Congressmen, these are Republicans who are introducing resolutions aimed at reducing anti-Semitism.
And of course, two of these are Jewish as well. There's three Republican congressmen. Ted Budd, he's a Goy from North Carolina. But then you have Lee Zeldin from New York. He's Jewish. And David Kustoff from Tennessee, who's also Jewish, who introduced House Resolution 782 to combat anti-Semitism in the United States. And we covered this in our Weekend Warrior show. But it's essentially... listen to some of these comments here. I can quickly read this here. The resolution is designed to encourage public schools to teach curriculum on the history of anti-Semitism and the Holocaust. It will also note the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, the BDS movement that we mentioned, the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement, and the ongoing issue of anti-Semitism in American society. The bill further calls for cooperation between federal law enforcement and state and local officials to hold perpetrators of anti-Semitism to account and to bring them to justice. And of course, they are now the ones who define what anti-Semitism is, or who is an anti-Semite, for example.
And we're going to get the history of anti-Semitism and the Holocaust is going to be totally from Barry Weiss's point of view, and that kind of activist point of view. And that's what we get in the educational system. And holding people accountable for anti-Semitism, does that mean they're going to put me in prison? What are they going to do exactly? How does this square with the First Amendment? It's just really unbelievable.
Listen to this. Ted Budd here, North Carolina guy, he said about the bill, anti-Semitic and anti-Israel attitudes often emerge because of a lack of understanding of the long and painful history of the Jewish people, and the fact that, and this is an astonishing admission, actually, and the fact that anti-Semitism has followed them to all corners of the globe for thousands of years, he said.
I tweeted about that.
You did,
Has followed them all over the globe for thousands of years for no reason at all.
No reason whatsoever. There's nothing there. It's just a disease that showed up when they showed up that plagued the mind of Europeans, right?
Yeah.
As a result, our Jewish community is feeling rattled, frightened, and unsafe, and we cannot allow these feelings to fester. I'm proud to lead a resolution that will help to increase understanding and rid our country of all anti-Semitic hate. Zeldin echoed Bud's statement, saying... they're talking about these attacks now, of course, which is another issue. We could talk about that later, maybe. But a lot of the blacks in New York have attacked, Jews up there, and they tie this into it somehow. Of course, it's still white supremacy and right wing terrorism and stuff like that. But that's the issue now. He says that these violent anti-Semitic attacks are being caused by raw hate, feckless leadership, a culture of acceptance, and the promotion of anti-Semitism, he said. I'm proud to come together with my colleagues to not only condemn these attacks, but to introduce a resolution that will help to rid our country of this poisonous anti-Semitism, Zeldin said. A necessary ingredient in the pursuit of progress includes increased education, awareness and understanding of anti-Semitism, the Holocaust, and the important existence of Israel. What do you think?
That's what it's all about. And you can see how, for example, these attacks in New York have been getting quite a bit of publicity. But again, you don't ever talk about the behavior of these Hasidic and Orthodox Jews that are producing this resentment in the black community. And then, you know, this resentment goes back to the 1930s. In Harlem, when the Jews owned all the stores up there, they started to very much dislike the Jews. And, so it's not, you know, it's happened before, it'll happen again. But, it's interesting that blacks are doing this because that's part of their, you know, blacks are their allies in this whole thing.
Yeah, exactly. That is interesting. Now, continuing this here, Morton A. Klein, who's the president of the pro-Republican conservative Zionist Organization of America, ZOA, said about this as well. This resolution also urges teaching the vital and historical importance of the Jewish state of Israel. He echoed those sentiments as the previous one did. One of America's strongest, speaking of Israel, he says, one of America's strongest human rights-loving allies and our only democratic ally in the Middle East. ZOA urges all House members to co-sponsor and to pass this bill. Which, of course, is just not true. If any country in the West or even, I mean, yeah, let's stick to the West. If any country in the West did what Israel is doing on, let's say, only just one issue when it comes to their ethnic survival and the borders and the walls and, you know, literally bombing people so we're not like them and stuff, the United States would turn against them, they would impose sanctions against them, they would say these are a fascistic country, et cetera, right?
Yeah, they would, and that's the thing. I mean, the chutzpah involved here is just amazing. I mean, they are trying to, and doing their best, and succeeding, really. Here they are.
They are succeeding.
Stating this in the United States Congress, and it'll probably come up for a vote.
But they don't have any power and no influence. And if you say they have, then you're anti-Semitic. But then they can pass resolutions to enforce their things that are pro-Israel, things that would benefit them as a group at the end, right?
Yeah, and if you say that they're pulling strings or influencing anything, well, that's anti-Semitic. It's amazing. One of these things, this definition of anti-Semitism that they use now includes things like saying Jews have power, essentially, that they control, say, the media or something like that. If you say that, that is now officially anti-Semitism. And, again, they haven't attached any criminal penalties to this yet.
Yet.
Believe me, they want to. They have done that in Europe, whatever they can, and they will do it here if they get a change in the Supreme Court. The First Amendment is still with us. It cannot pass that test but at this time, but certainly people like Kagan, the Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan, she's very much, she would vote for that in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
As probably the other two Jewish justices, and it's becoming a thing on the left now, censoring free speech and doing, you know, getting rid of the First Amendment is really part of the left these days.
Yeah, they have to shut down opposition because we've gaining the truth has
cost. They don't want people like us talking. And
No. Too many people open their eyes. They understand what's going on. So this is, of course, it's an information war. This is a battle to push back against what they just deem lies and propaganda. But then in reality, if you objectively can prove that, well, here are the organizations in, for example, America or Europe that hold a lot of power and influence, and many of those, they have Jewish interests, you know, people that are Jewish behind them and stuff like that, then they don't care if that is objectively true. They just say that, well, that's anti-Semitism, and that's supposed to be the killer of the argument right there.
Right, it kills the argument. And being labeled anti-Semite is just like the worst thing for an awful lot of people. It is something that you just can't stand up to.
Yeah. Let's continue listening to this the clip here, Bill Maher.
I'm sure people are going to say, hey, you're all talking about this when just this week, Bibi Netanyahu was talking about annexing parts of the West Bank, which I'm not sure if I think that's a great idea. But, you know, they have had 70 years to do something, to come up with a peace deal. If there wasn't this incessant hostility, yes, it's a terrible situation. Both sides have a claim to the land. The Jews 70 years ago were like, let's share it.
Right.
They were like, no, we want to kill all of you. Mm-hmm. So when you demand all and you don't get it, make a deal.
But also,
make a deal.
But also the left. But also the left is insisting, because it benefits their worldview, the far left, on conflating what I think of as Bibiism with Zionism. These are two very distinctive things. I am a huge critic of the current prime minister of the State of Israel. I believe that just as the Jews have a claim to the land, so too do the Palestinians.
They do.
And if Israel wants to be a democratic liberal state, there needs to be two states. But the idea, it's like, but those people are trying to say that just prime minister that somehow Israel doesn't have a right to exist. You would never make that argument that just because we have a terrible president right now, we should dismantle America.
But let's not forget that, first of all, 97% of the West Bank was on the table in the 90s in the Oslo Accords. They did not take that deal. Also, the West Bank was controlled by Jordan for 19 years. Where was the Palestinian state then? These are things you don't hear in the American media. Okay, let me ask you.
Here they are, the Zionist apologists now. They, of course, are pro-left wing when it comes to America and what they are doing. That's colonized. Not prying open the borders to the south of America is racism and fascism, but they're staunchly defending Israel and their right to steal land, which wasn't theirs to begin with, you know.
Yeah, and there are, this is disputed that they really offered that much to the Palestinians back then.
Yeah.
I don't think that ever happened. That's part of the Jewish apologia on this whole thing. The Palestinians probably could have been better strategically. But at this point, they're just continuing to take the land. It's not like they're, you know, they're hemming them in. And the way they treat people on Gaza is unbelievable. And you know, they have peaceful protests and they start shooting the kids, children.
Shooting them in the back and sniping them. And it's crazy. Again, if any other country did this, there would be. NATO would invade and they would like depose the leadership that did this, but somehow Israel is getting away with it and the media continues to cover for it. Yes, yet these individuals, they complain in the media and say, oh, it's so horribly anti-Semitic, but the level of criticism you see of is very mild and downplayed, and it's a little, maybe that wasn't the right move, but nothing happens, right? They continue to do what they want to do, and on top of it, I'm just surprised that a discussion about anti-Semitism, you know, in America, with all these violent attacks on Jews, that's kind of the linchpin of why they're having this discussion, ends up being about what's happening in Israel. It just shows the ties as well between the political sphere in America and the elite to how they view Israel as the most important component for them, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing the level of influence that the Israel lobby has in America. I mean, we fought these wars. Iraq was completely, in my opinion, result of the Israel lobby. The reason that they so much want to stay in Syria is because of the Israel lobby. I think Israel's foreign policy was to disrupt Syria, to make it a chaotic place, to have a civil war there. It's always easy to trigger a civil war in those Arab countries because you've got, you know, Sunnis and Shiites and they hate each other and it's all very, you know, clan oriented and everything. So they fomented that and they've actually sided with ISIS quite a bit.
They have.
And here we are, you know, thousands of Americans have died, trillions of dollars down the drain, for nothing and, continuing. And Trump, I think Trump was honestly wanted to get out of there. I think he still does. But every time he does something like that, the whole military foreign policy establishment goes nuts. And it's really a testament, really, to how this has become ingrained in foreign policy and military circles.
Yeah. And so much has become about that, including with Trump, who again ran on America first. It was build the wall, control immigration. Most of it now is essentially down to defending Israel,
That is what works with our elites. So if you do that, then that's fine.
Yeah.
But the rest of it, no, that's something. I mean, you look at these programs that the Israel lobby has put through. They have programs where they bring American military officers over to Israel, and repeatedly. So all these people have been over there. They've been propagandized. They know people on a first name basis. Who are part of the Israeli military structure, and so it's intertwined at this point. And they also bring over, all influential Americans are going to get invited for a trip to Israel. All expenses paid. They even take, college student presidents, that kind of thing. But anybody who's a rising politician will definitely get an invitation to Israel.
Oh, absolutely. We've seen that with Florida's governor. He was going recently. DeSantis and everything that he's been doing, groveling totally at the feet of the... And he was one of the first guys who passed this in the public schools as well, with the anti-BDS movement and stuff, that you cannot receive public funds. You can't work together with companies. What was it I saw here the other day? Was it Information Clearinghouse? Let me see if I can find that. Because it was a very interesting... Information Liberation. That's what it's called. Check out this headline here. It was regarding Abby Martin, who did not... She was going to do a speech at a university in Georgia, I think it was. And she was forced to sign a pro-Israeli loyalty oath before she did the speech. Yeah, journalist Abby Martin has revealed that she was blocked from delivering a keynote speech at Georgia Southern University for refusing to, quote, sign a contract pledge to not boycott Israel, to comply with Georgia's anti-boycott, divestment, and sanctions law. After I was scheduled to give a keynote speech at the upcoming Georgia Southern Conference, organizers said I must comply with Georgia's anti-BDS law and sign a contractual pledge not to boycott Israel, Martin said Friday on Twitter. I refused, and my talk was canceled. Interesting, yeah?
Wow, that's power. And you can see how they want to shut down free speech. They will do whatever they can to shut down this debate. And the college administrators confronted with something like this, they're always going to go with shutting it down rather than deal with the forces that will be arrayed against them if they don't.
That's just it. It's amazing that they're taking this route and they think you're going to win this way. They're going to create so much discontent. Let's watch. I think they go away from Israel at the end. Let's play the last bit of this here. It's interesting.
So let me ask you about this. You read something interesting about how we used to be afraid, and this is very personal to me because the anniversary of 9/11. I always think about the tragic events of 9/17 when I...
Oh, God.
What? That was the 6 days after
I went on, and
I got fired after that. I got canceled because...
You were canceled before canceling was a thing.
Before it was a thing. When it happened literally in TV, and it was because the sponsors pulled out. And you say now it's not really the advertisers, it's the readers.
It is. Because of social media, I believe that if all of the journalists who work for the New York Times, and frankly every other paper in this country...
That's your paper.
Yep. Got off Twitter for 6 months, we would see a wildly different and improved way of covering the news. And the reason for that is that Twitter, it's not just journalists, it's politicians. I was talking to the chief of staff of a popular congresswoman, and he was talking about how all of the staffs of all of these politicians literally just look at Twitter, look at the reaction, and then calibrate what the politician's going to say based on that immediate response.
That's an interesting point, because why do you think it is that so many people are censored, and if they're not all out blocked and have their accounts deleted, they're shadow banned. So people get that was so good with Twitter in the beginning, right? You could actually have lot of people directly complaining to a politician, and her argument here is, well, that's not good because then they just react to what they can see. But if they can filter out the criticism that they don't want to see and just push a left-wing narrative or even a pro-Israeli narrative or whatever it is, those are the only voices that will be heard. So it's still an interesting point she's making, you know?
Yeah, really. They want one voice. They want it to go back to the 1960s and 50s where you had three networks all owned by Jews and able to totally, you know, shape people's views of the world.
Yeah.
One view is what they want, and they don't want anything else.
And they're getting there slowly with, of course, censorship, and there's more and more alternative voices that are being blocked. And, YouTube is turning into just a monolithic, like a cable TV news channel, essentially. All the interesting, edgy content is gone from there, essentially, or it's being muted or silenced in some way, right? So, yeah, they think they're going to win this way. And I don't think they're going to win that way. What do you think?
I think they know that they won't win if we ever had a voice. If you were doing the evening news on a big network, I think we'd be in a different situation where you had millions of viewers. And, of course, they do that with people like Tucker Carlson. He lost, like, 70 sponsors. Because of his views on immigration, basically, I think. And they don't like, his views on foreign policy are not pro-Israel, really. They don't jive with the Israel lobby's views on intervention, wars in the Middle East, and all that. So he is not a popular guy. It's amazing that he's still on, but he certainly has a following. And I like, he's the best we have out there. He's not going to be explicit about people like Barry Weiss and their Jewish identifications and that sort of thing. But he's very good. But, they try to shut him down as best they can. The Antifa protest in front of his house and terrify his wife. And so he's had a lot of problems.
Oh, absolutely. I think, Shapiro or someone's going to be, lobbying for his position once he's gone. We'll see what happens. He's so popular, so I think they're kind of in a... they can't decide what they're going to do with him, but I think he's awakening so many people to, the small steps towards beginning to realize and open your eyes about what it is that's happening, So
that's what you got to do. You can't, if you did it, if you went out with the whole hog and talk like I do or you do, he'd be gone. But he's got a huge following. He's like the second most popular cable, TV.
Yeah.
So it is.
Now,
you look at his sponsors. It's like, the pillow guy and really small companies. I mean, none of the big companies. And that's the other thing. They've gotten all these big companies to be totally on board with the left, from Google, but also all the insurance companies and everything else that would advertise on a show like that. They don't do it because of pressure from the left.
Indeed, and those are so loud, those voices, and that was kind of her point, but I guess she was saying that, well, oh my God, they're complaining on Israel, so they're listening, or about Israel, so they're listening to those voices. So it's always about the rigid control, right, of the narrative, of information flow, of saying XYZ, we know that Israel has unique, dedicated Wikipedia editors and stuff like that. They have held conferences in Israel about how to edit Wikipedia to their benefit, and all these kinds of things. They're very effective in trying to control the narrative.
I haven't really read it, but can you imagine the Wikipedia entries regarding Israel? I mean, those are going to be totally vetted. I mean, my entry is ridiculous. I mean, it's just completely everything negative you could ever find about me.
Yeah.
And nothing positive, nothing, they'll have a list of criticism of my book. At one point I said, I gave my responses to these things, or at least I gave a link to my page on my website that had my replies to all my critics. They wouldn't even, it's gone.
No, they don't list. No, of course.
It's have any voice on there.
No. We played in a recent show, a recent Flashback Friday.
That's the one that they would not let me have just a link to say McDonald's has responded. It was on there for a while, but it's long gone.
Yeah, no, they remove it. We even had the co-founder. We played it in a Flashback Friday show. The co-founder of Wikipedia talking about how Wikipedia was compromised. It was like a lot of government people that now were the exclusive editors. It sounds it's lost its way. He was calling for a decentralized way of updating and publishing information and stuff like that, which was completely correct. But again, they might be able to control it for a while, but eventually people will see that, well, this is just lies. And eventually that bubble, I think, pops.
So many people don't see our stuff, and that's by design, of course, and they want to shut us out completely, obviously.
Yeah.
If they put a jail term, am I going to continue to do what I do if I am threatened with jail? What's the point? I mean, they have all the power. You just can't fight these people anymore.
It's beginning to look more like, of course, the Stasi or the Cheka or something that the authorities we have and the social credit score. I mean, we're in that environment now where it's so, and again, the laws that we showed there, that it's like, okay, sure, like you might not agree or sure, we have a different view, or at least we want to be able to present our information, our side of the story, and say, well, look at these organizations, look at these people. It's obviously that they're pro-Jewish first, they're pro-Israel, and we try to expose that. We try to show that side and say, hey, do you think these people have an agenda if they're sitting as a congressman in the United States, or they have the European Jewish Congress, or, you know, and they are passing on directives to the EU and stuff like that. Like, these people lobby. They show their interest. And we talk about that. They're trying to criminalize that now and turn that into a crime. But I think that they will overstep their boundary. Of course, that will harm a lot of people, definitely in the short term. But I think that generally, the more outrageous that they overstep their boundaries in this way of beginning to target innocent people and people who just share a different perspective, I think that's going to bite them in the behind at the end of this.
I would hope that. I certainly would hope that. I don't know. You combine that with all the propaganda, they'll just label people like you and me, or they'll label us as just haters. Any semis, they deserve what they get. I don't know.
Yeah, they're certainly trying to get it that way, and they are obviously successful in a lot of them in the accounts as well. But I don't know. I do have a positive attitude towards this. I see.
Yeah, that's good. I'm glad you like
it. Yeah. I'm seeing a lot of people. I mean, and again, it's not always about the masses and having the majority of people wake up, but those who are politically aware or they're interested in some way. That there's, again, with all the faults with Trump, just look at how much he has managed to totally tarnish the reputation of the mainstream media, right? Because of this aspect, that they have totally overreacted on this. And they're painting these straw men and they're reporting things which are just blatantly false. Anybody can find it out in 2 seconds by Googling or searching. And it's easy, they're an easy target to a certain extent. Sure, the masses haven't woken up, or maybe the left largely agrees with some of these perspectives, so they're not going to say that it's false. They just go along with it. But again, I think the majority have a suspicion today, with all the information we have available, that you can't just trust these authoritative sources out there. And that's a good thing, I think.
Authoritative sources. Yeah. I do think that what happened in 2016 with that election was an epic fail of the media, because they really hated him. And he did make a big point about that. I went to a Trump rally, and he's in there, he's pointing to the back of the room where the media is. He said, these are the worst people in the world. This very, argument. The fight was on. Of course, the media are sort of yawning because they've seen it every day. The same people.
Yeah.
But, it was striking to see that, and
yeah,
and that's a theme now on the right is fake news. Tucker Carlson was just laughing because some reporter on CNN, Brian Stelter, I guess, has a book out on fake news and how bad it is, and he's a CNN reporter. What a joke.
I know, it is a joke. You know, and again, but that's what I'm saying. They're like, people are just laughing at, sure, it's divided, right? It's schism is just, I mean, it's irreparable at this stage, but people are laughing at the other side.
What else can you do but laugh? I mean, it's like ridiculous. Did you realize, and the other thing they had on, speaking of laughing, that the Babylon Bee,
Yeah.
You were at that, yeah, they're on Twitter. I love them. they had him on Tucker Carlson. The people on the left are going after Babylon Bee and saying it's a hate site and all that. Everybody is making fun of liberals. Yeah. My God, it is insane.
They know they can't.
Now, it's so effective to do these things that they just cut to the say things that are just really funny, but right on the money.
Yeah, it, as you say, it cuts through all the lies and it ends with a person laughing at it, and they're exposed to like this. Yes, they're right. This is just ridiculous, right? And that releases the chains from people, the bondage that they're under with their mind in that sense, right? And so. They know that, you know, Saul Alinsky, we've talked about this so many times, so Saul Alinsky, the strategy of like making fun and ridicule, the left knows that worked. They did it. They employed it. And so they cannot allow us to do that very same thing.
Yeah. And that's you think of all the movies. One of the movies that struck me, and when I saw it again, and I don't think I took note of it much the first time, it was 1970s, was the Blues Brothers with John Belushi, I mm-hmm. think. And boy, were they making fun of these Nazis, these cartoon Nazis that they had in there, and they just love doing that.
Yeah, exactly. They keep doing it. Now, what do you think? There's more I want to try to get to here. Not going to be too much long-winded here. We've kept it for a while here already, but obviously your work is extensive. It's massive. There's so many aspects to it. Really, people need to read it. I want to reintroduce people to it, The Culture of Critique. People shall Dwell Alone. There's many books that are good. Of course, your latest one, Individualism and the Western Liberal Tradition. That's subtitled Evolutionary Origins, History, and the Prospects for Future. What else can you say about, what you've found when it comes to Jewish influence? How would you? It's very hard. It's very, very hard. Once you're steeped in it, you read the headlines every day, and you can analyze it. When you figure it out, done research, and you know what the truth is and stuff, and you see what the narrative is in the media. You know what kind of image they try to spin, and with that, you can see through things much more easily. But one of these things, and it's just what Barry Weiss kind of addressed, that one of the big, boogeyman they're trying to paint out there is the people that are arguing that, well, there are Jewish interest groups out there, and they're going to do things which are beneficial to them and to the detriment of us in the West, right? That most of the changes that we see, that we've got, the radical changes that we've gone through in the West, and this includes, of course, open borders. It includes the overall, for using it, the liberalization of our societies. You have the sexualization of it, or the sexual revolution, many of these things. And they have not exclusively been driven by Jewish people, but there's been a lot of Jews on the forefront of many of these culture shifts and movements, right?
Yeah, and one of the points I make in Culture Critique is that Jewish attitudes on immigration are apparent in the 1920s. They wanted open borders then, and that never changed. So it's not like they suddenly saw the light or something, and this goes way back. And they wanted to change the ethnic balance of this country. And of course, they were not successful for a long time. We did have the 1924 immigration law. It cut down immigration dramatically and biased towards Western Europe. But, 40 years later, we had the 1965 law, and here we are. Jewish power gradually increased during those decades. And, there's no question in my mind that is why we are here. That this is a very powerful, very aggressive group, and they hate Western Europe.
Why is that?
Well, it's like you see the little screen you have there right now, all these expulsions. Their view of history is that Western Europe has treated Jews very poorly for centuries, and they've expelled them. And then you had in Russia, you had the pogroms in the 1880s or whatever, and then you had the Holocaust. And so that's their framework for thinking about the West. And one of the most important developments really was. I mean, almost all Jewish intellectuals say in 1930 1940 were Marxists. They were very much into the idea of class struggle, right? But the Frankfurt School were the first to really realize that it's not about class struggle, it's about race. Because they saw the working class in Germany voting for Hitler. That should not happen if you're a real Marxist. So what happened in Germany conflicted with Marxism. And so they developed the view that it was really about Western ethnocentrism. And so ever since World War II, the big thrust of the Jewish community, and of course it's not just the Frankfurt School, it's all their influence in the academic world, but also in the organized Jewish community, because, you know, by the 1950s, they started distributing things to school teachers and so on, taking this point of view that white ethnocentrism was wrong and it was evil, and you could see what was happening in the South and all that with the race issue down there, and so that's the whole civil rights thing and seeing white people as racist. Really, that is a central thing, more so than socioeconomic class, because after all, Jews are the highest social economic class there is in America. So that is a big change, because now all the propaganda is about race. It's about how whites are racist, how they have any white identity or white pride in your past or civilization, wanting to keep America white majority, all those things are seen as pathological and racist and fundamentally evil. And that is the work of the organized Jewish community.
Now, we've seen a lot of articles like this recently, too, where it's like I think it mostly, again, stems from, let's say, Europeans, the way that they reject the behavior of Israel. But a lot of Jewish papers they write about were, like this one here is another one today, I think it was from yesterday, from the Jerusalem Post. Do Europeans know what Jews contributed to every field of life? Do people anywhere, even young Jewish men and women, know how European Jewry helped shape modern life? And it's like this touting all the time. Like we did all these wonderful things, and if we weren't here, you would be living in, I don't know, like a squalor or something, or scientific advancements. There's a lot of these touting things where, contrary, like, to how if Europeans just remotely suggest that they are proud of anything that they have contributed, then they're white supremacists all of a sudden, right?
And the poster child for that, of course, always is Einstein.
Always Einstein.
Always Einstein, because they don't want to talk about the Frankfurt School. Even Freud now, I mean, they will talk how influential Freud was, but I think it's getting less so because, Freud is widely seen as a charlatan, and my writing is that he's also an ethnocentric crusader against Western civilization. But, that is, John Derbyshire accused me of that. You know, he's saying, Jews contribute so much and we gotta see things from that. Okay, name one thing that wouldn't have been discovered by Europeans. And I also think that the whole Nobel Prize thing is at least partly a matter of Jewish ethnic networking and influence on that.
There's studies on that come out, actually, showed that it was very interesting. They compared a Scandinavian kind of attitudes towards these things of being very easily bamboozled or bulldozed over, essentially, that you had one Jewish person that come in on the committee and they're recommending this other person, and of course that was a Jewish person, and the rest of the committee was like, oh, well, we got to look at that. They seem confident. They seem to know what they're talking about. It was, a lot of other viewpoints of that. Essentially, the Nobel Prize, and then, of course, to add on to that, Kevin, even the Nobel Prize is not good enough. Now they have this own achievement award. I forget what they call it now, but I exposed it in the, I think it was the Barbara Spector video that I did, the recent one, where she was going to Israel for this big event. She was speaking there together with the Rothschilds and many other powerful Jewish individuals in attempt to try to unify the Jewish diaspora. Did you see about that event? Did you hear about that?
I don't know about that. Sorry.
Interesting. I have to show you that one day. There's a lot to go through here right now, but it was essentially, I replied to it, to the Jerusalem Post kind of story and thanking them for Barbara Spector, because obviously Sweden would never have survived without her. But there was some other.
That's That's the most astonishing statement, that Europe must admit all of these other peoples or they will not survive. What? You know, like, would you apply that to Israel? Would you apply that to, is it common sense? Would you apply it to Africa? Would you apply it to Korea? I mean, it's nuts. But that's their, you know, they want multicultural. They want to diminish white power, because a homogeneous white society is seen as nothing more than a precursor of Nazism, you know, national socialism, and that is what it is. And so they're going to oppose that with all they can.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Here's the video here. Yeah, it has the article in it. I don't have that actual article up, but in the video I have it. Leading Jewish thinkers and activists from six continents convene in Jerusalem to launch effort to achieve unified vision for global Jewry. And this was, it was called Our Common, I think it was Our Common Destiny, I think it was called. And I made an expose on it, and Barbara Spector was there talking about this, which of course would be, why would she even be there if she was this insignificant person that didn't have any influence and she didn't matter, like they've tried to say right after that clip came out, where she's talking about how Europe must be multicultural to survive. She was received awards from the Swedish king. You know, she's high up there and very high regarded. Here it is. Our Common Destiny is a conference that they put together. And again, there was Rothschild bankers there and stuff like that. You see, I read some stuff from their website and things like that. And if you've had any European organization that had called for a unified, you know, European world, you know, of all the different European peoples everywhere, it would have been called white supremacy or, you know, fascism or something like that. You know what I mean?
No, yeah, absolutely. Any idea that white people have common interests is actually anathema to this point of view.
Now, one thing I want to ask you about here, too, at the end, we're going to wrap up here in just a little bit, but I wanted to get your take on the upcoming Richmond gun rights rally, pro-Second Amendment groups, patriot groups from, looks like now, all over America are going to descend on Richmond, Virginia Monday to protest the intended gun grab, essentially, by Northam and all these other people. These are newly elected Democrats who Virginia, of course, have for the first time, has shifted red? Blue from, I was confused the colors. They shifted blue from being red for the longest time. They've turned Democrat, right? And largely, it should be pointed out too, largely due to the fact that Virginia has been flooded with immigrants, specifically Northern Virginia.
Everybody acknowledges that.
Yeah, and there's papers about that too. They write about it, you know?
Georgia. Well, yeah, so that I don't know what's going to happen. You know, these people, the pro-Second Amendment people are really, they're not going to give up their guns without a fight, I don't think. This could be something that, I see this as more of a possible beginning of a civil war than anything else.
You have a bad feeling about it? Do you think something will happen? Will they try to hijack it the way they did Charlottesville?
Yeah, that's the problem. With Charlottesville, it ended up being, I think, a disaster in a lot of ways. But, it won't really be because I don't think, well, I can just imagine some leftists infiltrating and make it look like it's a Nazi thing.
Let me show, speaking to that, sorry to interrupt you, but look at this. Here's a tweet here that came out today. From Tom DeWeese. He says, I'm in Richmond, and I've just received information from a very reliable source concerning Monday's rally against the legislators' gun grab. Antifa have rented 7 buses to bring in their thugs to cause trouble. The report says that they will be wearing MAGA hats and wearing NRA garb. They will pretend to be pro-gun people. Meanwhile, others posing as Democrats holding anti-gun signs will stand on the other side. The Antifa thugs pretending to be pro-gun will attack the sign holders, making it look like the pro-gun people have started violence. This is the plan. If you're attending the rally, be aware, be very careful. I don't put it past them. Let me put it that way.
I don't put it past them at all. I mean, in the Charlottesville thing, there was this guy in a German army uniform going around with a swastika flag. And then, you know, all of a sudden he posed for the cameras, got in the front page of the New York Times or something.
Yep.
And that was the end of him. And he got out of a car and left. You know, I mean, I don't believe that was real. And, you know, it's very unfortunate that woman died. That shouldn't have happened. but that's what really fueled them. And
that was the police fault. There was the Virginia State Police, and we've talked about this so many times, but they shoved the right wingers into the hands of Antifa, right? That's what they did, and they caused violence. Right. They created the scenario, and I very well think something similar could happen in Richmond. And if it's not exactly executed that way, it will be something else. I had a show with the former Navy SEAL Matt Bracken on here, did that recently. He was talking about the location as well, like people will be boxed in, there are chain link fences everywhere, they're gonna have snipers on every rooftop. He just basically said anybody could just fire a shot, or even that it sounds like someone is firing a shot, and you could have potential just total chaos, or you have intentionally bad actors that come in to create violence, or even pose as the tweet suggested. You know what I mean? It's
yeah, I would think that Antifa would be there. And these people are going to have guns, I guess. It could be really wild. We'll see.
Yeah, I don't think the Boogaloo will start that day, but I think it will be an opportunity, just like Charlottesville was an opportunity for the intelligence services to shift blame and also attention at the same time onto populist, right-wing nationalist, those who are countering the anti-white messages, that all those different groups came together. They showed their support both for Southern Heritage, this attack on history, by tearing down the statues and stuff like that. They took that opportunity, and even if it wouldn't have happened during that Charlottesville rally, it would have happened to the next one or the next one, right? If these continued to be successes. This, I think, and so they essentially managed to pull that off. They essentially managed to say these are dangerous terrorists. They have to be controlled and silenced, and that's what we've seen, right? Now I think it's the turn of pro-Second Amendment patriot movements to be smeared in the same way, both with the association with Trump, but also to suggest that they're like, these are dangerous individuals. We should take their guns, but it's a much larger group, the patriot movement.
Yeah, you can imagine if there is a big blow up, they will, first of all, be blamed entirely on the Second Amendment people. And any violence and all that will be blamed on them, and it will be used as a rallying cry, well, we have to have more gun control and these people are dangerous. And, you know, a lot of people from Charlottesville are still battling lawsuits. It's just really pathetic. And,
yeah, it takes a long time for them to complete a circle, if you will, of this. But they do it. It takes years for them to take down people, but that's what they do. They have the means, they have the finances for it, and they will ruin people's lives for just opposing their replacement, for opposing their people and their culture and heritage being attacked and ripped up from underneath them. You know,
absolutely.
Well, Kevin. Please go ahead and plug your stuff. Tell us about some of the things you do have already, of course, all your books. Tell us about the website, Occidental Quarterly, anything you want to plug, really. Go ahead and tell us.
Okay, yeah, well, regarding my books, Culture Critique and Separatist Discontents have been banned from Amazon.
Big surprise.
Barnes and Noble. But Individuals in the Western Liberal Tradition is at Amazon, as is People That Should Go Alone. And you had the Occidental Observer website on there. I'm still the editor. I'm also the editor of Occidental Quarterly. I'm very proud of the material we put out. This is by Tobias Langen. He's a regular author. Andrew Joyce is a regular author. A bunch of people, and we're getting more now, it seems. So we've survived this. They tried to deplatform us. We can't get credit cards. You can't use PayPal. Can't use any of those things, but we're surviving, and we'll see what happens. But we have to keep on going as long as we can. But as we've been discussing throughout, really, there's a huge movement to censor us and to censor thought in general. And what they want is they want leftism, but without any anti-Israelism, and that is what they're going to shut down anything that departs from that if they can. And they're well on the way to doing that, but they have a lot of power. But I don't think the Supreme Court is going to be in any mood to to change the First Amendment without at least a couple more new appointments that would replace the conservatives.
Here's, of course, you do have the books in the footer on the OccidentalObserver.net, and I clicked in on Culture and Critique, as you said, is not there, Amazon, not Separation and Discontent, but People That Should Dwell Alone is there. That's still a hit for that. And also, of course, as you say, the latest one, Individualism and Western Tradition. So they can buy it through Amazon. I propose people don't. How do you get the other books that are gone from there now? Do you have another shop or something set up?
Well, just the other books are Barnes & Noble.
Barnes & Noble, okay, yeah.
Yeah, that's the only thing.
No online way to purchase them. I guess that they are online. Obviously, Barnes & Noble is online, but I mean another shop or store. Or something like that.
No, I guess not.
Okay. All right, guys. Well, definitely check that out and support Kevin's work. Is the best way to support your work, is that, what would you say, to get the Occidental Quarterly, is to buy one of the books or donate? How do you prefer?
Yeah, people contribute to Occidental Observer or buy a subscription to Occidental Quarterly. It's only $60 a year for the print version, $30 for electronic, and we really need it because the deplatforming hurt Occidental Quarterly more than Occidental Observer because people used to just sign up for recurrent subscriptions. And then when this deplatforming happened, MasterCard and all the credit card companies wouldn't allow it anymore. Well, then, they just didn't. And people aren't used to putting checks in the mail and they just dropped out. And so we need more subscribers. And it is sort of academically oriented, but it doesn't cost that much just to support it, even if you don't want to read all of it. It's definitely worthwhile and appreciate people would do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely check it out, folks. It's TOQ online for short for the Occidental Quarterly online.com. Yeah. Check it out there. Yeah. I have some of the editions and they're excellent. There's so many good articles in there and you guys work really hard on that. It's a nice booklet or whatever you want to call it as well that's printed and it's very nice. So definitely check it out. All right. Well, thank you so much, Kevin, for coming on. I really appreciate it. Keep your spirits up. Keep up the good work. And again, just thank you for doing everything you're doing, being a brave dissident in these times and being out there and being an academic in this environment and talking about the things you do. So thank you to you and for your work.
Thank you. And I really appreciate what you do, obviously. And I admire your optimism. I'm it's good. We have to be optimistic. We have to think we can win this. Or we really, what's the point of doing it? We can win. It's happened before.
It's the only way. There's no other.
This is against us, but people like us have to stand up.
Absolutely. We've done it before, as you said, and defeatism, I think, is our greatest enemy. If we don't believe we can do it, we're never going to be able to do it. We have to have faith. We have to believe it. We have to believe in our people and in our ability to wake up. And when the going gets tough, that there's a lot more people with resources and means and skill that's going to come to our side, and they're not going to want what's coming. That's when things are going to be really interesting, I think, that when a lot more people will start pouring into these areas, they're awakened, they realize what's happening, and they don't want it, they don't like it. And we'll be there as voices. We have the arguments, we have things laid up, we have it presented, so yeah. Don't give up, Kevin. Don't give up. Keep fighting.
We have the argument, and we have morality on our side.
That's correct. We have the truth on our side.
Vision. And one of my ideas in individualism and Western liberal tradition is that white people won't act unless they think what they're doing is moral. And what we are doing is moral. We're trying to help our people. We're trying to save our civilization. And we'll see. If we're successful, but what we are doing is a moral, right thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thank you, Kevin. You know what? Let's end on this clip. It's like 27 seconds long, but it's actually by G. Edward Griffin, an old kind of. He's looking at the elites and globalists for many, many years, many decades actually. He's talking about this aspect of truth being on our side, like that's a weapon that we can use. Yeah. It's a very powerful comment. Let's just check that out last thing here.
But because they are lying, it's possible to expose them. And this is their Achilles heel. Now, by comparison, we have nothing to hide, therefore we have no reason to lie. And we wouldn't want to, even if we could. Truth is a far superior weapon than deceit. It's a weapon which is denied to them. And in the end, it will be the decisive weapon that destroys them completely.
Go. There you go. Okay. Yep, well, summarized. It's pretty good. That's just tell the truth, people, and we will win. All right, thank you, Kevin, so much. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Goodbye.
On October 17th, YouTube deleted our channel Red Ice TV, and a week later, Red Ice Media, our backup. We had no strikes at the time on either. YouTube never sent us an email, they did not get back to us regarding our appeal, and despite thousands of people writing Team YouTube, there has been zero communication from them after we were thrown off the video publisher's website. Luckily, nothing has been lost. Everything is still available on redice.tv and redicemembers.com, together with all our members' exclusive content. Make sure you get a subscription and support us. A lot of our recent videos and shows were automatically backed up on our BitChute channel. Subscribe to us there, bitchute.com/redicetv. More recent shows are embedded via BitChute on redice.tv, and we have always hosted our own MP3s on the website, the podcast version of the show. We have RSS feeds both for the radio show, the interviews, and a separate RSS feed for the videos posted on our website. Subscribe to both of these feeds to get the latest content, and this is a great way of getting a notification as well as soon as new shows and videos are available. We are in the process of uploading older shows to our BitChute channel now. We will go back and update shows on redice.tv that previously was linked back to our now censored YouTube channel. Subscribe to our BitChute channel, bitchute.com/redicetv. We are rebuilding our subscriber base with an already large audience over there. Join the 22,000 that have already subscribed to our BitChute channel. We are also uploading all our videos to our Facebook page, facebook.com/redicecreations. Just search for Red Ice on Facebook. When we live stream, we multi-stream both to Twitter and Facebook, but more importantly, dlive.tv/redicetv. Get the DLive app, follow us there, and you'll get notifications when we go live. They have super chats incorporated on the platform as well. Thousands have joined us on DLive already, and that's a great option for live streaming. If you want notifications for any of our content, make sure you join our Telegram group. Go to t.me/redicetv and enable notifications. You can get the Telegram app for your phone or your computer. It's nice and secure as well. Notifications goes on Telegram every time something new is available from Red Ice or other important updates that we have. In addition, make sure that you follow us on twitter.com/redicetv, gab.com/redicetv, minds.com/redicetv, and instagram.com/redicemedia. Help spread the word about our videos and shows. Share links, post it in comments, tell friends, family, coworkers. We lost access to 333,000 subscribers on YouTube, but we'll rebuild the audience on new and better platforms that don't censor and accepts politically diverse opinions. YouTube will be outcompeted by platforms that simply can uphold U.S. law, recognize the First Amendment, but also the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. The Supreme Court already ruled that there is no so-called hate speech exception to the First Amendment. Publishers like YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and Google use the hate speech excuse, this clause, to silence dissident political views that they don't agree with, since they are biased political publishers that meddle in the election process and admittedly now has shown through leaked footage and documents that they want to sway public opinion by controlling what speech they allow or don't allow on their websites, even though they are granted special protection under the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, by the United States government. This means they should not be allowed to operate as a publisher like they do now. They should be a neutral platform, but time and time again, we have seen that they are not. All we ask is that these companies uphold United States law. Don't break the law by calling for violence, which we never did. and then these publishers should accept everything else that is protected under the First Amendment, since they are based in and were founded in the United States of America. They also receive corporate welfare, massive subsidies from the U.S. government. This is taxpayer money, in other words. Considering their special protection status granted to them by the government under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, they should recognize free speech. And the U.S. Supreme Court have already ruled that so-called hate speech is free speech. RedEyes.tv, RedEyesMembers.com. Visit our websites. A lot of great new updates in the work for both websites. Thank you for watching, and thank you for your support.